Welcome to The Local Take with Kiplin Primus on Jazz 91.9 WCLK. This weekly public affairs program features dialogue and community engagement with leaders and organizations making a difference in the areas we serve.
This week on The Local Take, I speak with Devin Barrington Ward about what defund the police actually means. Last month, I moderated a panel discussion for the Center for Civil and Human Rights for the nonprofit organization Equal Dignity. The panel was made up of various activists from around the nation around the subject of defund the police. The question to be answered was exactly, what does that mean? One of the panelists was a young activist right here in Atlanta, Devin Barrington Ward. He is the founder and managing director for the Black Futurist Group. His organization is a social justice innovation firm that works on public policy, community organizing, the media, and they use other tools to ensure an equitable and liberated future for Black people. So, Devin Barrington Ward, welcome to The Local Take.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be a part of the discussion. And it was great being a part of the discussion you referenced that you were the moderator for at the Center for Human and Civil Rights.
Now, I just gave your organization's kind of about us speech, but can you break that down for our listeners? Exactly what does the Black Futurist Group do? And, you know, why haven't we had a group like this before now?
Well, I think one of the things that's really important is that our main job at the Black Futurist Group is really reimagining the future, because we have to reimagine the broken institutions and frameworks and systems that don't serve Black people. And so we were birthed out of a recognition that there's a lack of innovation as it pertains to public policy, a lack of innovation as it pertains to community organizing and advocacy efforts, and a lack of innovation as it pertains to how we portray and tell our stories in the media and with other news outlets. And so our goal is to really just stand in the gap and be an advocate for Black folks, but not just be an advocate for Black folks, but a future where Black people are honored, where Black people are liberated, and where Black people have systems and institutions that actually serve them and that are, you know, serve them from the start and not looking at Band-Aid reform. And so I think oftentimes, you know, we weren't necessarily at the table, or other organizations that are like us weren't at the table, because there was a lack of innovation and a lack of willingness to bring different perspectives and folks who are willing to reimagine what our future can look like to the table as it pertains to how we build better communities here in Metro Atlanta and across the world.
Now, how did you come to be involved in public policy? Because this is not the sexy work. This is mainly research, is looking at, you know, how public policy came into place, what needs to be done to change it so that it works. You know, a lot of people call this the nerd work, and, you know, most people do not want to be involved in it. How did you come to embrace this way to actually affect change?
Yeah, you know, I was really fortunate that at my high school there was a speech and debate team, and so I got really immersed in the speech and debate team, and it created opportunities for me. But one of the things it also did was created some frustration, and it created frustration because no matter how good I was at a debate tournament, no matter how many trophies I brought back from, you know, a national competition, it didn't change anything in the real world. It was just competition. And so that really inspired me to take the skills that I learned in speech and debate and apply them into the real world. And luckily, I was able to have opportunities afforded to me through folks like Stacey Abrams. When I was 16, I worked on her first campaign for the State House of Representatives. And from there, that really afforded me a lot of different opportunities to work in the political space, but also to drive public policy. As I became older, you know, life happens. And so I'm also, you know, Black. I carry the identity of being a member of the LGBTQ community and seeing people impacted by, again, broken systems. I was working in the state Senate, and I saw my best friend become HIV positive in a city that is led by Black folks, in a city that is led, that has the CDC in its backyard, in a city, though, that also has some of the highest rates of HIV as pertains to the Southeast, and even some zip codes have higher rates of HIV than some areas of sub-Saharan Africa. And I was seeing very grave disparities taking place in the community with the people that I care about. And so in some ways, I got involved with public policy out of a desire and a need to save my life and the life of people that I love. And so it was done out of an act of necessity. We all are gifted with different talents and skills, and I'm appreciative and very blessed that the skill that I have to offer to the world is being able to come up with different public policy initiatives, advocacy campaigns, and ways to engage the media that moves our society closer towards liberation and freedom in our lifetime for Black people. And if Black people achieve liberation and freedom, we will all achieve liberation and freedom, because there's never been a time in this country that Black people have been liberated, where Black people have been honored and respected, and that has come at the expense of someone else. All of the oppression in this country originates with the original oppression of Black people who were brought over here as pieces of property.
Now, how did you come to focus on defund the police? And you had this focus before it was a hashtag. So how did this become part of the focus of the Black Futurist Group? And why did this become part of that focus?
Because we've defunded everything else. We've defunded education. We've defunded healthcare. We've defunded affordable housing. We've defunded housing services and services for people who are unsheltered. We've defunded the things. We've defunded mental health. And so when we have defunded those things, it causes for us to, invest disproportionately in law enforcement, in police, prisons, and jails. You know, Georgia has a $4.8 billion spending habit on police, prisons, and jails, whether that's the local government, county government, state government. That number has increased exponentially over the last 40 years to 122%, according to the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. And so when I look at why other areas of the work that we do as the Black Futurist Group as pertains to public health and affordable housing and homeless policy, I have to look at, we are oftentimes fighting these battles with a lack of resources. So where are the resources going? And in Georgia, they abundantly go to police, prisons, and jails. We had the opportunity to work on, reimagining public safety through the defunding of police, prisons, and jails through a really amazing campaign that we were contracted to work on called Communities Over Cages ATL, which was envisioned by Women on the Rise, which is a group of formerly incarcerated women who are prison abolitionists who recognize that we have used cages instead of investing in community, and have used handcuffs instead of investing in healthcare to really address the issues that are taking place in our communities. And so we were contracted with them to serve as co-leaders of that campaign and to help really organize a lot of the other civic organizations, civically minded businesses, and the elected officials to being able to see that now is the time to, one, renegotiate our relationship with the Atlanta City Detention Center, because we were spending $32.5 million on a jail that didn't hold people that were true threats to public safety. Nobody at the Atlanta City Detention Center had, if you were there, booked into the City Detention Center, you did not commit a rape. You did not engage in aggravated assault. You did not, murder someone. Your crime was jaywalking, pedestrian in the motorway, loitering, an expired tag, small amounts of marijuana, things that we know are not threats to the public safety, but quality of life policing that stems back to the 1996 Olympics, because the city jail was the first Olympic facility that was built for the 96 Olympics, because we did not have a plan under a Black mayor and a Black city council. We did not have a plan for how we were going to address the mental health and substance abuse issues that were causing people to take up residency on our streets. And so instead of getting to the root cause of the issue, we decided to build a jail. And so, you know, fast forwarding to 2019, last year, where we were able to, you know, through our advocacy efforts, get the mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, to create a task force that we were also appointed to close and reimagine the future of the Atlanta City Detention Center. And that work has led to the budget being reduced from $32.5 million to $3.5 million, and that money being reinvested into programs like the Atlanta Fulton Pre-Arrest Diversion Program, which is an alternative responder model and provides alternatives other than the carceral state for people who are struggling with substance abuse, homelessness, mental health challenges, and other things. And we were also able to reduce the jail population significantly. When we started that campaign, the jail population was 750 people. You know, now currently there are less than 10 people at the Atlanta City Detention Center on any given day. And so these are real reforms that are connected back to defunding the police, because while it is a jail, who puts the people there that were in the jail? The police. And so naturally the next target would be to really talk about how we need to reallocate our public safety dollars away from more police officers, more squad cars, more military equipment, and towards more mental health services, more housing opportunities, more economic opportunities. Because public safety doesn't start with police and prisons and jails. It starts with the people and community and investment.
So now, Devin, how do we explain this concept to a layperson so that they understand what it means? Because when you say defund police, some people are completely turned off. It's an immediate, you know, we cannot go forward with this. Even though, as you said, every year education is defunded, affordable housing is defunded, affordable health care is defunded, and there are no foundations, you know, sending teachers $500 checks. How can we present this so that people understand that if someone is violent, then a police officer is needed, that police officer comes? But is this, if this is a challenge with someone having a mental health problem, maybe a counselor or a social worker will come. For every problem that we call the police for, you don't actually need a police officer. So how do we get people to understand? Is it to say reimagine public safety as opposed to defund the police? How can we get lay people to understand exactly what you mean when you say, you know, reimagining public safety?
Well, there's a process, right? And so in order to reimagine, you first have to start with the defunding. And the defunding process was, you know, through here in the city of Atlanta, there was a very clear process that the city council narrowly actually came close to approving, but was voted down by one council member. And so what the legislation would have done was to lockbox half of the Atlanta Police Department's budget into a trust fund while elected officials, community organizers, mental health officials, and other people that were relevant to the conversation could, one, go through the police budget and see where the waste is, because there's lots of waste in the Atlanta Police Department budget. Go through and see where there are things that the police are doing that we actually don't need to do and that could be reallocated to another, an alternative first responder. And so the defunding aspect is very important, because when we give $250 million in a $600 million city budget, when $250 million is allocated towards the police, that's a significant amount of money that is allocated towards the police, and that means it's at the expense of something else. The other thing that people have to ask themselves is, really, what do the police actually offer in community? For example, when the last time you had to call 911 for the police, the majority of 911 calls are not calls about violent crime. For example, I've had my windows out of my car busted out. And while that was a very inconvenient and not a pleasant experience, I didn't need someone with a gun and a badge to show up and provide me a police report that I could take to the insurance company to file a claim, right? Oftentimes when we talk, a lot of folks are talking about the young lady, the 8-year-old, our baby who was, you know, gunned down in front of the Wendy's, you know, through, you know, kind of an occupation of the Wendy's. There, you know, the outrage is valid. And we can also hold that outrage and that anger for the folks who took that baby's life, while also recognizing that that doesn't mean that we should not continue the calls to reimagine public safety through the defunding of police, because there have been plenty of 8-year-olds and plenty of young Black girls who have been harmed and the victims of violence in the city, and the police were not able to keep them safe, and they were not able to provide justice for people's families. I go back to last year, there was a student from the AUC that reported that she had been sexually assaulted by her roommate's boyfriend, and made the report, and nothing happened. And 3 days later, she was dead in a field in DeKalb County. Right? And so we really also have to ask ourselves, are we getting the best bang for our buck as it pertains to public safety with our current structure of policing? And I think if we were really honest with ourselves, we would come up with an answer of no. And so it does require people to ask themselves some very clear questions about not the perception of what you think the police do, but what do the police actually do? What are the services that they actually provide in your community, and not just what you see on TV, or not just what you see in an hour-long newscast at 6 or 5 o'clock? And so those are some of the ways that we engage people as it pertains to kind of some of their misconceptions about what police actually do in community versus what we perceive police do to preserve public safety.
I'm Kiplin Primus, and you're listening to The Local Take. We're talking to Devin Barrington Ward from the Black Futurist Group about reimagining public safety. More information can be found at theblackfuturistgroup.com. One of the places that gets so fraught with mishaps, it seems, is the traffic stop. And it's the 21st century. It doesn't seem like you really need to have a traffic stop. If someone's light is out, you can easily run their tags. You know whether they have insurance. You know whether the car is stolen. Take a picture of the tag, send them a ticket. And the police officer never has to engage with the citizen. Are these the types of innovation that you're talking about? And, you know, one of the other things we know in that education defunding, that we have lost a lot of school counselors, you know, part-time school nurses, but we pay to have a police officer there.
And so I think, you know, to the point that there are innovations that are currently available to us right now that could reduce the scope of policing in our communities. You know, for example, like, you know, I'm not a big fan of them, but I recognize that no one has ever been killed by a speed camera. you know, when someone's speeding, instead of someone being pulled over, they're sent a speed camera ticket in the mail and they have to pay their ticket. And it reduces unnecessary police interaction. Another thing that we don't talk about is, there is no place currently in Atlanta where if I am a person in community and I have a conflict with another person in community, where I can go and have mediation and get some conflict resolution. Oftentimes the police are being called out to resolve conflict, and we have seen over and over again that calling someone with a gun and a badge does not de-escalate the situation. Oftentimes in heightened emotions and heightened energy, it actually escalates the situation further. And so we're talking, some of it is technology advancements, but we also have to be careful about not increasing the police surveillance state as well. But also some of it is, you know, community-based. Most of it is grounded in community-based solutions and responses. There are not counselors in the schools. And so if young people don't have counselors in the schools, and a teacher's job is not necessarily to be there to resolve conflict. So then the conflict spills out from the school into the community, and someone is harmed. And either they're harmed because they have harmed one another, and now the police are responding to that, or the police are responding to the conflict in progress instead of conflict resolution specialists being coming out and coming to the scene to resolve the conflict and restore the peace. And so those are the type of common sense solutions and innovations that can reduce the scope of policing in Atlanta.
When you talk about the community mediation, I was immediately reminded last year visiting Ghana for the year of return. In their communities, they have community mediation. The elders mm-hmm. will talk to the young people about whatever it is, or the young people will talk to the elders, but they don't call the police. They actually do it in the community. And the community is responsible, you know, for those types of, to solve those types of conflicts. So that's very interesting that you mentioned that.
There are models to do it. And I remember just really quickly, you know, being in high school, I was trained as a peer mediator. And so that was the alternative when students were in trouble. If there was a fight or something of that nature, the administration gave the opportunity for young people, instead of to get a suspension or a mark on their record, they could go to peer mediation and work it out with fellow students that would serve as mediators and coaches in the midst of the crisis, to bring some sort of resolve to the conflict that didn't involve students being suspended and their academic records being impacted. And so if we can do that in high school, why is peer mediation available in some high schools, right, but not available to adults that are having much more complicated conflicts?
Clearly, there's some models around that we should adopt and embrace. Now, Devin, what are some other challenges that you are fighting with public policy? Can you also share any successes that you've had?
Yes. Yeah, so like we recently, as I mentioned, we had the success around the Atlanta City Detention Center closure. That facility is nearly closed. It's kind of open in a way that a lot of us have asked who have served on the task force, the mayor, for a closure date, because we don't have a significant amount of people that are there because of the reforms that we have made over the years, like the decriminalization of marijuana, the adoption of bail reform that ends the cash bail system at the city level, and other reforms that have significantly reduced the jail population, and so at the city jail. And so that is a victory that we are still celebrating, but there's still work to be done. More recently than that, we had got news last month, at the beginning of when the uprisings were really taking place in Atlanta, that at the same time these uprisings are taking place around police accountability and reimagining public safety and defunding the police, the Fulton County Commissioners were about to adopt a $23 million proposal to use COVID relief federal money, $23 million in federal relief money for COVID response, to expand the Fulton County Jail for 120 isolation units at the jail. That was problematic for several reasons. One, we don't need to be expanding the Fulton County Jail. We need to be depopulating the Fulton County Jail, because every year we find out about more and more about how there are people in the Fulton County Jail that don't need to be there. Last year we found out about a Black trans woman who was in the Fulton County Jail for 6 months on a jaywalking charge. So before you start building more jail cells, we need to start talking about how we decarcerate the facility that we have from individuals who don't need to be there. The second reason why that was an issue is because those isolation units wouldn't be finished for another 2 years. The hope is that we are in a different place with the COVID-19 pandemic. So what would be the purpose of those isolation units? And the third thing, which is actually more disappointing, is that they would essentially be used as torture chambers, where people would be spending time in solitary confinement, which we know deteriorate people's mental conditions even worse, further than just being at a correctional facility in the first place. And so we took 150 protesters down to the Fulton County Commission meeting and demanded that commissioners come outside and address us and explain to us why they felt, why the commissioners that were supporting it at the time felt like this was the right path forward. And because of the pressure that we were able to apply that day, they voted to kill that proposal and also voted to never bring it back up. And so that was a significant victory. And now we're working towards what are the ways that the public can have more say, either through participatory budgeting process around how that $23 million is spent to provide relief in communities that have been impacted by COVID. We all are always working to address the HIV epidemic. And so we are continuing our work at the state level to ensure that we have a PrEP drug assistance program. PrEP is the drug that you can take once a day if you're HIV negative to help you stay negative. And we know that it is very effective at keeping people negative from acquiring HIV, but it is also still a very expensive drug, particularly in a state that has not expanded Medicaid. So we are working bipartisanly to make sure we were able to get members of the Black Caucus, including State Representative Park Cannon, to support that effort and champion that and work with her Republican colleagues to move it through the process. So we did get authorization from the state to create a PrEP drug assistance program in certain counties. And now we're working to secure the funding for that program through the state budget. And so those are just a few of the things that we're working on. There are multiple projects and clients that we have are fortunate to work with as we look at the different pathways that we build the Black future for our communities in Atlanta and across the world.
Well, Devin, I am glad that you all are doing this work. And quickly, can you tell our listeners how they can keep up with you and the Black Futurists group?
Yes, so I hide in public. So just if you're on any social media platform, Devin Barrington Ward, I will come up if you put me in the search bar on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Devin Barrington Ward. And then you can also connect with the Black Futurist Group, and that's Futurist with an S, blackfuturistgroup.com. And you can find all the information there. And, of course, if you connect with me on social media, the links to the Black Futurist Group are also available for you as well.
Devin, I want to thank you so much for taking the time this morning to share this very important information with us. And I'm looking forward to the work of your organization and what you all can accomplish. Thank you so much.
I appreciate the platform and being able to speak with your listeners and you about the important work that we're doing. And all of us have a responsibility to build the future and to reimagine these broken institutions so that they better serve all of us.
The Local Take with Kiplin Primus on Jazz 91.9 WCLK is produced by Kiplin Primus, Jami Wellman, and Rob Maynard for WCLK. If you have comments about today's program or suggestions for future programs, you can leave a voicemail at 404-880-6211 or email kiplinprimus@gmail.com. You can listen to these interviews on demand at wclk.com or via the WCLK app. Thanks for listening.